Promotion Man, the true backstories of the most iconic bands in the world, told by Fred Myers and interviewed by me, L.A. Lloyd. Get involved and interact on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. You'll find the links at promotion-man.com. That's promotion-man.com. Download the weekly Promotion Man podcast on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, or your favorite podcast provider.
Harold Childs, everybody.
Hello, how are you?
We're good, man. We were just kind of bullshitting over here waiting for you. We started, you know how you start a conversation and you go a zillion different places? So we, like the Karen Carpenter's documentary, you know, about her and all that. Because when we look at your bio, the thing that I think jumps out pretty quickly is obviously A&M in the early days. And Lloyd, who's on with us here.
Hey, Harold.
Hey, Lloyd. How you doing, man?
Doing well, man.
Good.
So Lloyd said to me while we were off mic, you know, was the Carpenters the first big band for A&M?
Well, not really. No, because, you know, the history of A&M goes back to Herb Alpert and
Tijuana Brass.
Right.
And then there was the Baja Remember Band, and there was
Chuck Mangione.
Chuck Mangione, he came later. Baja Remember Band, there was a group called the We Five that had a lot of, was like a similar kind of a Carpenters kind of things. There may have been 30 acts on A&M before the Carpenters that sold records. They were not necessarily Chris Montez.
Oh, Brothers Montez Johnson. The Brothers Johnson was
Strawberry Letter.
Strawberry Letter, yeah.
Sure. So all those back, but the Carpenters, in that area. Let me go back to A&M. I started at A&M. I was hired as a national album promotion man because A&M at that point, A&M was. I sold millions of albums, but they didn't. But they wanted to have somebody that just concentrated on all the different acts they had on albums. So I traveled the country and I dealt with mainly the MOR stations then. And A&M helped convert the MOR stations into AC radio because MOR radio at that point was still doing with Perry Como and Victor Moan and all that stuff. A&M came along with the Wee Vibe, with the Baja and Herb Alpert and all that stuff. Bert Bacharach was on with all albums. All that helped to convert MOR into a younger, kind of hipper audience with AC radio.
And for the audience, MOR stood for Middle of the Road.
Right.
Middle of the Road. And they played all that stuff. They were there because before A&M, I worked for RCA, and I was a Pennsylvania rep for RCA, and I had all those acts, Eddie Arnold and all that stuff on RCA. So MOR was that. So A&M was that company that came in, and when the Carpenters hit, I mean that was a big thing, and it helped establish the AC format, adult contemporary, because it took on another whole thing. I think at that point, Elektra Records had a group called The Bread.
Right.
And The Bread was Elektra. And they and the Carpenters, we were to kind of move MOR into a hipper MOR into going for different demographics.
And today they call it Yacht Rock.
Yeah, Yacht Rock. And then didn't A&M distribute Ode Records, ODE, that Ode had Records? Capistry by Carole King?
Yeah, but before that, A&M distributed CTI Records.
Oh, I love and all, oh, I got a crazy story West, for. I have such a crazy story West, to tell you.
Which was Wes Montgomery. It was George Benson.
Patty Austin.
Patty Austin was Paul Desmond. It was all A&M had that. When A&M had, and I promoted that, so A&M had CTI. A&M was one of the bands that helped establish the Quiet Storm format because that's when R&B was leaving, was getting out of the AM R&B stations, but converting to FM stations, And with HUR, the station, Howard University station in Washington, started to do a format called The Quiet Storm. And that included all those kind of other black hipper acts, the George Benson, Patty Austin, who couldn't get really played on the AM R&B stations only because if they didn't have a hit single, Quiet Storm helped build those acts. That was A&M's distributor. And then Ode came after A&M.
Hey, Harold, I got a question for you.
Right.
Were you actually in on that photo shoot for whipped cream for Herb Albert? Because I'd love to see girl back in the day, man.
I was on the East Coast then, Stanley.
She was pretty strong, man, and I was just a young kid.
I just saw a picture of her. She's 81 or something like that.
Wow.
On Facebook, and she's still got that. She's still chiseled, and she still looks great.
Nice.
It's just an anniversary of that cover. She was on Facebook, I saw her.
That's awesome.
So this audience is more of a classic rock audience. And when we looked at, like, Peter Frampton, and again, off mic, I was a mail boy. It was my very first job in the record business was a mail boy at Together Distributing in Atlanta, Georgia.
Right.
And it was Motown, which was a huge independent label, and then A&M, which was a huge independent, and they came together. And at that moment in time, Nazareth had Love Hurts, which is still a song that gets played today on classic rock.
No, I'd love to have the publishing on that song.
Right?
No doubt.
I mean, every commercial on television out here, it's Love Hurts.
I know, right? And then Frampton album, not the Frampton Comes Alive that blew up, but the Frampton album, the studio album, was out. And why the live album? I guess it was the energy of the crowd and, you know, the way he just performed those studio tracks live became one of the most best-selling live albums ever.
Because he was just at that point after the studio album where his audience and his fame was starting to spread around the country. And he got the demographics of his grew. And when that album hit, I mean, that album was unbelievable.
I was telling Lloyd how albums...
I mean, I have to tell you something. All the A&M people in the world could take a bow, but nobody thought that album, including me, was going to be as big as it was.
I don't think anybody did the business or out of the business.
And here I am in the warehouse, and there's skids of albums, meaning there's 25 albums per box, and there's probably a couple thousand albums on a skid. And there would be five or six or seven of these skids of Frampton Comes Alive.
Wow.
Yeah.
Sure. Oh, no. We had that. That was a tremendous, tremendous album.
Do you remember what that sold total units? Do you just recall?
You know, I couldn't even, I'll find out and let you know, but I couldn't even remember. But it was in the millions. It just kept selling and selling and selling. And he was touring around the country, and I saw him up in San Francisco, and I saw him somewhere else in Chicago. Every time I would go on the road, not to see him, Frampton was coming to town. So everybody wanted to go to Frampton. All the radio people, top 40, everybody wanted to go to Frampton concert, whatever. But it was huge.
Hey, I remember back in the 70s, I was a kid when that album came out, and there was a thing called Columbia House. You know, the big marketing thing, you pay a penny and you get 14 albums. Well,
that's
nobody ever paid for the albums, and, you know, I was kind of curious how that went down as far as sales were concerned, because it seemed like nobody ever paid for them.
Well, they did. People did. The percentage of the people, the vast majority of people that got it did pay for it.
Yeah.
There was a small percentage, like most young kids did, and they just ordered the stuff and got it at home or whatever, that didn't pay for it. Oh, yeah.
If you're listening, Columbia House, I swear it wasn't me.
Yeah. So, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Getting back to that whipped cream album, you know, when that album came out, we were at a different time in this country. When that album came out, there were some chains, record chains, that were hesitant to carry that album.
Oh, yeah.
Because
it's controversial.
Sears Records. Sears had a record department in all the Sears stores.
Yeah.
JCPenney had records in their stores. And it was all grandmas and whatever. And all. They were very reluctant to carry that cover.
That's a classic.
So you were with A&M Records when they signed The Police and Joe Jackson?
Yeah.
I mean, those two albums came out pretty much at the same time. And I was a Warner rep in Michigan. And no offense to you and your company, but your A&M guy wasn't all that strong up there at that moment. He didn't last very long. And so I was promoting both Joe Jackson and Police Roxanne because I couldn't believe how believe how great those songs were. It was like, oh my gosh, these are just amazing. Yeah.
The thing was that A&M, what A&M did was, it was such a great company, and it was had such
a great company.
Insight about the market, and Jerry and Herbie and people that they hired, they hired the best people when it came down to artist development and artist relationship. And what we had to do in the cases, because both those acts came from England, remember?
Yes.
What we had to do is, because they were new in this country, we had to give them tour support. So those acts, we actually paid to put them on the road.
Wow.
In order to get them established, because that they were basically unknown in this country. They were unknown. They were known in Europe and stuff. So we supported them once they arrived in this country to do these tour supports to build an audience.
Do you have a Police or Sting story you'd like to share with us?
No, not yet. When they came home and they did tours and whatever, they toured the country, Police, and they were a basic kind of guys that drove the country with a trailer on the back of their car and went around, because we would book them from Phoenix to Albuquerque to Denver to Seattle, whatever. We put them on the road, and they were pretty together band, whatever. They worked their asses off, and by the time they got from one city to the other, there wasn't a lot of controversy about them around the country. They came, Sting and those guys came to work.
Wow.
You know, so there was not a lot of things you could point out, but they made their appointments, they did their interviews. I mean, we had Nazareth also.
Oh, that's right.
Those guys were just wonderful. Party. Nazareth, they would do their work, and then then you would have to drink with them all night and do every other conceivable drug.
So I'm just kind of curious on the actual A&M headquarters there in L.A. Now, if am I right, was this the old Charlie Chaplin studios back in the day?
Yeah, the old Charlie Chaplin studio. It was also the old studio, the old CBS studio.
Okay.
That had... They did the Perry Mason show was done there.
Wow.
All those CBS shows, Red Skelton.
Wow.
All that was done there on that sound. I mean, I ran into Red Skelton on the lot, and you would run into Burl Ives. You would run into Raymond Burr.
Wow.
They all would come back there, because when we weren't using that sound stage, they would come back there and just... to do, you know, small clippets of stuff at A&M.
So this show is called Promotion Man, and you hired probably what's the epitome or the poster child for what was considered the best promotion man ever, correct?
Yeah.
Well, I got to tell you, this was Jerry Moss. Jerry Moss hired me. Like I said, I was a kid in Philadelphia. I was with the RCA regional promotion guy, whatever. But I knew.
But didn't you hire Charlie Minor?
Yeah, well, I would get to that point. When
okay.
I knew MOR and radio and that stuff like that. So when I came out of, they hired me to move from Philadelphia, and I was 22, 23 years old, to move to California. The only thing I knew about California was Ozzie and Harriet was done out here in 77 Sunset Strip. You know, so I moved from Philadelphia, this kid, kissed my mother on the head and said, "I'm going west, mother. I'm going west." She said, "West? What's west?" So I came out to California. Jerry Moss, who said at that point, I did the national album thing. Then when I was finished with that, Jerry said, "I want you to come to California and start a promotion department."
Wow.
At that point, Don Graham, who was the national promotion director and who was a famous guy with them, but he was top 40 driven. Jerry wanted somebody that could put together a team who could do album reporting, because it was Progressive Radio was starting, FM Radio was starting. So Jerry wanted to have a team out there of guys that could handle that, guys and gals. So he hired me, and he said, all right, go out there and put together a team. Now, my point was, he said to me then, remember, if you hire him, you got to fire him. So don't come back to me whining if you hire him. If you hire him, you got to fire him. So that's the way we built. Charlie Minor was one of the guys. When he was, Charlie came, we had had a, I guess we had had a, quite a few guys around the country before Charlie. Charlie came out of Atlanta, and Charlie was recommended by one of the publishers down, and music publishers down, and then knew Charlie. So I went down to Charlie and went down to Atlanta to interview guys, and I met this whack job named Charlie Minor. And I went out with him. I interviewed him. I must have interviewed 12 different guys. A lot of people wanted the job. And I interviewed this guy, Charlie Minor, and oh, God, whatever the whole thing. And spent some time with him. We went out that night. He insisted that we should go out that night, which to my detriment was. Went out with him that night. Of course, we went to strip clubs and every other place that Charlie could find in Atlanta. And we met and we talked and whatever the whole thing. And I hired him, maybe because it was somebody dancing in front of my face. But I hired Charlie. And he, I often tell the story that I woke up that morning with a hangover and whatever, and he called, hey, buddy, how you doing? I'm fine, Charlie, what's going on? Well, when do I start? I said, start what? He says, well, you know, I gotta get ready to come out to the coast and whatever. And I says, Charlie, come over, have a coffee with me. I'll go to the coast before I go back to California. And I sat there and I said, you know, I don't remember whether I hired that guy or he hired me. That's how good Charlie was. He was driven. He wanted to get to California. He had a great personality when it came to people. He didn't care what the situation was, what the thing was, whether it would be pop radio or black radio. Charlie had connections with everybody because they loved him, because he had a directness about him, and it was a no-fear thing. If you could do something for him, he was your buddy. That was Charlie.
True that.
Well, and the very first promotion I ever set my eyes on was at Together Distributing. And I'm having a cigarette break out front, and I hear this winding of a sports car engine, and I see this flashing gold thing because the sun's shining. And all of a sudden, it's in front of me, and it parks, and it's a Dino Ferrari. And out comes Al Monet.
Wow.
Al Monet came out of New Orleans.
New Orleans, yeah.
Al Monet was absolutely one of the best guys that I hired. Monet, yes. He had a way with, once he got into his own stride being a national guy and didn't try to copy Charlie, Al Monet was the best because he worked hard. He worked too hard. He had to tell, hey, Al, you've been on the road for 3.5 weeks. Get the fuck off the road and come on. What are you doing out there? Whatever the whole thing. He was driven about, and the promotion guys in the field all liked him. And Monet came out. He's, as a matter of fact, I saw him only about a year ago. He's out here.
How is he? I got to call him because I ended up working with him at Virgin.
Yeah.
Right.
So how is he? Is he good?
He's, you know, he had, what was it, Parkinson's or what it was?
Oh, shoot.
Yeah, I saw him. He's, you know, he's home. His wife, he married a great gal, and his wife, and they live over in West L.A. And he's dealing with it. You know, he loves movies. They go to the movies. They watch stuff, and he's fine. You know, with all the new medicines and all the stuff, he's been better than holding his own over the last couple of years with this and whatever. So nice. He's okay.
Good.
So Harold, did you work with A&M in the '80s as well?
Yeah.
So I was kind of curious about one that kind of jumps out at me from the 80s was Bryan Adams, and a story that Mark Tindall, you work with Mark Tindall, right?
Right.
He was telling me that one of the great things he used to do before ad day is he would go to somewhere in Beverly Hills or somewhere, invite Brian to come out and hang out with him on the pool, and they would literally call program directors all day long. It's like, hey, this is Mark Tindall from A&M. You want to talk to Brian Adams? And, of course, the radio guy kind of gets caught off guard because he's starting to build up some success. But I thought that was a brilliant way of kind of marketing your product, man.
Yeah.
Well, Tindall came after me, but that was the thing that he had gotten from Monet and guys like that. He didn't originate, but that's the way it was. If an artist was in town, an A&M artist was in town, whether it was Sting or whatever, in the hotel, and they would give you the time to do it, that's the thing was.
That's
it was
awesome.
Hollywood calling, was Beverly Hills calling, and that's what we would do.
And it pops when you say that.
Right.
Yeah.
What about Supertramp? Right.
Supertramp. You know, Supertramp, again, A&M paid for all these tours of these acts. These acts came from Ming, and Supertramp came over, and we basically put them on the road. We would not allow them to open up for anybody. We paid for the tours.
Wow.
So we actually paid for them to be the number one person on because we wanted people to see them and be able to not to say, well, this is this band. We wanted them to establish themselves as a headliner. So we paid for Supertramp to all that. And all that merchandising thing with Delaware, with whatever, that all came out of we had the most incredible merchandising and marketing department at A&M. That's the thing that lot had. And you could do so much there. You could do, you know, when it came to doing posters, when it came to doing displays, all those things were shot and done at A&M.
Do you think that, you know, the Breakfast in America might have just been just because they were, you know, loving what was going on and how they were taking off? I mean, do you think maybe that could have been some of the concept for some of those songs on that album?
Some of the ideas, yeah, Breakfast in America, because we had a guy named Jeff who was in charge of the market, was a brilliant guy. Jeff Aroff, he was a brilliant guy when it came to marketing and putting things together. He worked directly with the acts, and it probably came from Jeff and the band to take that approach and to put Dolly the stand up in all the stores and whatever. We had an incredible relationship with the retail stores around the country.
Well, I wouldn't consider Supertramp a prog rock band by no means, but they sure didn't sound like your typical, you know, rock band in the late 70s, early 80s.
Yeah. Right? Yeah, that was a unique thing. That's what made them that audience, and that's one of the things that we were able to develop based on the fact they open up as people didn't just say, oh, they're playing for this band, they're playing for that. They open up as the number one band on the stage.
Right.
So people had a chance to get into them and listen to them and develop with them and the whole thing. So it was all that development time. A&M took years in order to develop some of those acts to get them to that point where they got that. And one of the reasons why we were successful, because a lot of the labels would try to come out with singles of the bands at first and go to Top 40 Radio. We already had a foundation with all those bands on AOR and Progressive Radio. So by the time they came and we were ready to find a single out of those albums, retail, and it was so much aware of them, they helped us. They helped us develop all those acts. We would have never been the success as we were other than retail. It was Tower Records. It was Warehouse. It was all those great chains around. It was Corvettes on the East Coast.
Harmony House Records.
Harmony House in Detroit. All those acts came out of the fact that we were so strong in retail. We put as much attention to retail and as we did with radio when those acts came out. We really had our connection with them. You were talking about earlier about we did mention Sergio Mendes at the beginning of the conversation. Sergio Mendes was a huge act in this country, with Herb Alpert. And if you remember the album that Sergio Mendes had called Fool on the Hill, was an album of the band sitting on a woman's butt. and we had a tough time with major chains around the country who wouldn't carry it.
Oh my gosh, I remember this one A&M promotion marketing that they had this gorgeous girl, dark-haired girl, very hot. She's sweaty, and she's sitting on a block of ice. And
that's
I don't know if that's
a Gatto Barbieri album.
Gatto Barbieri album. There you go.
Yeah.
So
yeah,
when did you transfer? When did you start at Warner Brothers?
Oh, that's years. Much later. I was at A&M 17 years.
Yeah.
That was much later. The Gatto album. We had a contest around the country. Because we had some very sick promotion people, by the way, who used that cover for all kind of degenerate things that they had, you know. going into telling secondaries, you know, you can be the next cover if you give me some shots, some Polaroids of you sitting on ice. So, I had a contest with them, the most depraved contest they could come up with or whatever. So there were thousands of Polaroids circling around the country from these promotion guys promising these, you know, women that they met that they could be the next cover of the Gatto thing. So, but yeah, but that was that, and that was a huge record, that Gatto album, you know.
Well, one thing that I really love that you said is how the labels use retail, you know, because obviously you think it's the labels just going to radio. And dating back to the beginning of the Promotion Man podcast, I mean, we talked about how everything kind of was in a cycle or in a circle there. It was about retail. It was about the labels and the promotion staff. And it was about the program directors who had the great ears that actually gave songs a chance when they trusted their promotion man. So it's kind of cool to hear you verify that.
No. The radio thing. A&M wouldn't be A&M without the retail situation, because they were the people that you knew what was going on in the street. So there was a kid behind the counter, it was a girl, or the guy behind the counter, who when you went into a town as a promotion man, that's what I learned when I first got to A&M before I took over. The other thing was, one of the things you had to do at A&M, you had to be both.
Right.
It was not just paid to go into a town and wine and dine and wait for a program director, music director to play your record. You had to go out there and create your own marketplace. So we would spend time taking those retail people to lunch, the clerks, not the bosses, the clerks to lunch. So they would be so keen to our product, and they would be so into our product. So if a radio station called them about a piece of product, they would tell them about this A&M record that was selling.
Nice.
Or they would hype our product with them. So a part of the success of A&M Records has to be led right on the doorstep of how the promotion guys work radio and retail at the same time.
Yeah, I did as well.
You guys were way ahead of Twitter and Facebook back in the day, man. He did it the old-fashioned way.
Oh yeah, yeah. Because it was that, you know, when you had a Frampton album, you had a Carole King album, which was on Ode Records, and that was distributed. It was Lou Adler's label, distributed to A&M. Marshall Blonstein was in charge of it, but A&M carried carried all the records. I mean, it was Carole King. That was a major, major, major product, and then retail played a major part in how that record developed.
Right.
By in-store play. We always joke about in-store, but in-store play was vital in those days, and you had to get to the turntable before those crumbs from Warner Brothers or Columbia got there.
So was Cheech and Chong on Ode as well?
Cheech and Chong was on Ode, another one that came out of progressive radio and hip retailers getting into it. You couldn't get it played on the radio at first, so you got it played on hip record stores around the country.
Right.
And then their followers and stuff like that, and the progressive radio guys, you know.
What was that like for you as a promotion man to work a comedy album? Because, I mean, obviously Cosby and folks like that and people had success with comedy albums, but what was it like for you doing that?
You know what, it was more than just a comedy album, because it was a cultural comedy album.
Right. Oh, right.
It locked into the progressive AOR radio.
Right. Yeah,
so it was those guys and those nighttime guys and those lunatics who were all on radio. I mean,
they had something to have fun with.
Right.
Yeah, nobody else could play it.
Yeah.
So they played it at night, and they would get called. And remember, a lot of the radio guys, on progressive radio especially in those times, a lot of those guys worked in retail stores. Because they didn't make any money being an all-night guy on a progressive station. So they were clerks. A lot of them came off from retail into radio.
I did that.
So they knew. You did that?
I did that at Camelot Records. Yeah, I was working at a radio station at night and Camelot during the day.
Oh, yeah. So that's how one of the things again, it gets back to that radio and retail thing. One of the great things is that we had guys that were and gals that were into the product that knew how to make things happen, knew what their listeners did. They called them, you know, late at night and being on radio, knowing what they liked and what they wanted to hear. So when A&M came out with product, and a lot of that product that A&M came out with that came from England, a lot of the young kids out there, the record buyers, the young people, they knew about the product before radio did in the States here because they had gotten copies from their friends in England.
Imports.
So imports. So a lot of these guys on retail, jocks at retail, they knew about this stuff. So when it was released on A&M, they were our best supporters.
Wow.
So they went out there and played this stuff. So we had a lot of fun.
So going back to Cheech and Chong, remember when he says, Dave? And he goes, no,
Dave's
not
here.
And I think that's really that bit that blew them up on FM radio.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
They would come.
My office was right. They would come over to the old record. My office was right. And when I always left the door open, they would walk by my office and stand in the office and look at me. And they said, no, that can't be him. That's the guy on the Uncle Ben jacket, isn't it? That's the guy on the right. You fucking asshole.
So let's transition over to Warner Brothers. When did you start with them?
I was president of Quincy Jones's label.
Okay.
That was distributed by Warner's, and once Quincy decided that he wanted to take some time off and go to and do movies and stuff like that, they folded that label into Quest Records into Warner Brothers, and Warner Brothers also had huge smooth jazz acts.
Right.
Huge.
I mean, they had all of them, George Benson, Earl Klug, David Sanborn, Bob Lowe. They had all
Bob
those
James.
Acts over there. Michael Franks. All those acts were Warner Brothers, so I took the Quincy thing into the Warner's smooth jazz thing, and that's when we took over the smooth jazz stuff.
How about with the pop side with Quincy during the Michael Jackson and We Are the World era? I mean, were you involved? I know it's different labels.
Not at all. That's why Quincy wanted to, when he gave up the Quest thing,
gotcha.
He wanted to spend more time doing producing and stuff. Not at all.
Gotcha.
No, not at all with the Michael Jackson stuff.
Okay.
I see Quincy every once in a while. He's around town.
He's a good guy. I was at a convention, a WEA convention, and he was going to speak, and him and I were in the lobby, so I had a chance to actually have a one-on-one with him that was just kind of random. But, man, when you look at his documentary and his history with Frank Sinatra and, you know, and how he really helped Frank Sinatra reframe his sound and bring his sound to a different delivery.
Right.
Genius. The guy's a genius.
Yeah, Quincy was great at that. Quincy, when he had his label, didn't want to. He had the label, but he didn't spend a lot of time in developing the artists and stuff on the label. So that was after having it for a while. He decided it was best for him to be that independent producer kind of situation that he got into. But Quincy was also. Quincy was on A&M.
Oh, yeah, in the beginning.
Wow, I didn't know that.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, as an artist, as his own artist.
James Ingram.
Yeah, James Ingram.
Austin,
yeah.
And all the Brothers Johnson. All those acts were Quincy acts on A&M.
Wow.
So, Harold, after going through this illustrious career, and then, you know, here we are in 2021, the music industry's completely changed. Did you just say, goodbye, I'm done, or are you still involved in it?
No, I was involved. I was involved up until about, I guess about three years ago. We had a company with Ernie Campagna, who was my partner, who was the vice president of sales at A&M. And we basically did older acts or older jazz acts or we called them coffee table acts.
Right.
The kind of people that had bucks to do their own albums, but there was no way anything big was going to happen to them. But there were good albums for those people to have on their coffee tables to give to their friends and their children and stuff like that. We got some radio play, some retail, but for the most part, there were hobbies with a lot of the people that we worked for who had the money, who decided they wanted to do this kind of thing, and they wanted to hire a professional team to put it together for it. So it was a lot of fun because you had to, but you had, it was a constant schooling thing to let people know that you're only going to go so far with this.
Right.
You know, this is a nice album, whatever the whole thing, but it's going to be very difficult. And that was the end of, during the end of retail.
Yeah.
Well, I got a recommendation for you. You should call Frampton and tell him to come alive again.
Yeah.
I think he moved to Cincinnati.
Yeah, that's where he does live in Cincinnati.
I met his wife. I met his children when he was out here. He did an album about 5 or 6 years ago with through Universal. They put out an album with him, and the guy who did it was the president of the label at Universal. The guy named Gallo, who used to be the vice president of sales at A&M, and he signed Frampton to do this classical rock album. And I met with Frampton and his wife about 5 years ago at a party, whatever the whole thing.
Nice guy. How did you get involved with Timothy B. Schmidt of the Eagles?
Timothy B., I worked for a company after that. I was a consultant for a company called Music Research. Music Research was a company that tested music for radio for record labels. In other words, Clive would come and have 3 or 4 cuts from an album, and he would send it to him. And Music Research would actually had a office there with 12 people on the phones, and they would send out tapes of these 4 or 5 cuts or 3 or 4 cuts to these people, and then call them 3 days later and say, "What did you think?" and then rate what they said about it. So that's how Clive got all his information about singles and stuff out of the albums. They didn't tell you, Music Research didn't tell you that you had a hit, but they would tell you which one rated the best.
Right.
And Timothy Schmidt was a good friend with Larry Heller, who was the president of Music Research. And Timothy, when he decided to have an album out, he hired myself and Larry to go around to the country and try to promote this album.
Nice. Well, this has been a great interview.
Yeah.
Learned a lot, which is always what happens on the Promotion Man podcast. We never know where we're going to go, and we learn a lot about this historical stuff that was the birth of classic rock and certainly...
Yeah, well, it was that way, and the birth of the smooth jazz thing, because we did it back with CTI Records. It's the interesting thing is promotion people often got the short end of things because people thought they were just guys that went out there and did, or gals that just went out there and, you know, paid just jockeys and drank and all that stuff. But the fact was there was a lot of technical work in the sense of being able to timing, being able to get to that retail person, being able to get that band on the road, to move them across the country, to get the interviews, to do all that stuff.
Right.
You know, it was, and you had to drag the artists out of the bed sometimes. They didn't want to do interviews all the time. And a lot of the Europe acts from England didn't quite understand how it all worked here. So it was a constant education thing of showing them how this works and how it builds to that point. And the A&M people, because of the history of the company and because of how Jerry and Herbie were with their people, me and all the people that were, we gave them every tool. Jerry Moss's slogan was, "Don't ever come back to me and say, 'If I had this, I could have done that.'"
Wow.
I'm giving you the records. I've given you the money. I've given you the you got the direction. This is what you have to do, and go out there and do it.
Awesome.
I remember one great meeting we had. We called it the Lake Geneva meeting. And we took all the regional sales guys and the regional album guys out to Richmond for a meeting to plan the fall. And during that year, we were cold as hell. But Jerry Moss, during that summer, we were cold, and Jerry Moss was in Europe. So he came back to the States in order for the fall with the company, and he stopped over in Chicago, and he came to the Lake Geneva meeting. Everybody was sitting around. Everybody had their cashmere sweaters tucked around their shoulders, drinking the best wine. And we hadn't had a hit in 3 fucking months. He was nuts. Jerry never got angry with his people, but he called me And he called Bob Feed, who was the senior vice president of sales, to his room that night and says, "You guys got 1 week to turn this thing around."
Wow.
You better. And we were so afraid. That was never Mars. It's the only time in the 70 years that he would have. But he saw what we didn't see. We were so turned on to ourselves and being A&M and being whatever the whole thing, not realizing that we hadn't had a hit in 3 months. So everybody at the company, so I went to all the promotion guys, and the sales guy went. We went to woke him up. This is about 12 o'clock at night. "Hey, we just left Moss. He is very unhappy. You guys got to get the fuck out of town tonight. Go out. You got to rent a car. Get the hell out of town and be back in your markets by tomorrow morning, because that shit's going to hit the fan."
Everybody's ass is on the line.
Nice.
I was flying back to California, and I knew Jerry was flying back. I changed my flight and flew to Houston. In order not to be on the same plane with Mars.
Smart move.
I flew to Houston, Texas, stayed there 3 hours to make sure Mars had landed in L.A., and I was not going to be sitting in first class with him, or whatever. Whatever. So
that's
it was
funny.
That kind of thing where he touched us about what our jobs were. Because in any situation, in any company organization, every once in a while, the boss has got to kick your ass.
Right.
And,
yeah.
And we were flying, man. We were flying. We had all the ads. Everybody loved A&M, the retailers, the radio stations. You know, everybody walked around with their Gucci shoes on and their cashmere sweaters. We thought we were the top of the thing. Well, we hadn't had a hit in 3 months.
You still got to have the hits.
And Ma said, "What do you think this is? This is not a yacht club. You guys got to get the hell out of here." Boy, we had. We refer to it to this day as the Lake Geneva meeting. It's like a mafia meeting or something. Like the Lake Geneva meeting, whatever. All
right.
So,
well, Harold.
Those great times.
Thank you. Thank you for being
right,
on
guys,
the show.
See me again. Give me a call, and I'll fill you in with some other stuff if I have to, okay?
Great. Excellent.
Thank you so much.
Okay, guys. Take care.
All right.
Bye.
Promotion Man, the true backstories of the most iconic bands in the world, told by Fred Myers and interviewed by me, L.A. Lloyd. Get involved and interact on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. You'll find the links at promotion-man.com. That's promotion-man.com. Download the weekly Promotion Man podcast on Apple Podcasts, iHeartRadio, Google Play, or your favorite podcast provider. We appreciate you subscribing and spreading the word, and thanks for listening.